This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So the title of my presentation is Detection of Clinically Relevant Variants in Autism Spectrum Disorder. I think it's a little bit different than the title I gave you when you first contacted me, which was So Many Genes in Autism, comma, Why? It's essentially the same question, I just rephrased it a little bit differently. I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground, so I'm going to move relatively quickly, but I'll try to draw out some common themes and messages that we can discuss at the end of my presentation. So I'd like to give you some background on, and just general observations, the current state of genomic studies in general and in autism. I'll talk about, secondly, about copy number variation in autism spectrum disorder, or I'll call ASD, a model to study rare CNVs and mutations as risk factors in disease. And then I'm going to talk about our most recent whole genome sequencing data in autism, and this is unpublished data, and much of the data I'll show you is actually unpublished, but in particular this section is entirely unpublished. And then just make some wrap-up comments under the general grouping of a view from 44th parallel north. Some of you seem to have got the joke, but if you draw a line across the Canadian-U.S. border, that's the 44th latitude north. And I think we have a quite unique vantage looking down in how science is conducted in the United States and often can make some observations that you might not see yourselves. And I'll try to draw some things out from our own research, in particular where I think things are going in the field of genomic applications in autism and in general in human genetics research. So some background and observations. The message I'd like you to take, and of course many of you know this because you contributed to these observations, certainly in autism, there's significant genetic and clinical heterogeneity. Everything I will tell you really points to that and needs to take that into consideration and needs to draw from that when we try to design the next set of experiments or diagnostics or treatments going forward. Why do we perform research in autism? I think this is most important because there have been many, many false hypotheses followed in the past that ultimately the truth will be found in scientific investigation in autism and other neuropsychiatric, neurodevelopmental disorders. In particular, earlier detection of ASD and related conditions can benefit health outcomes. Better understanding of the causes of autism will benefit medical management, and I hope to give you some examples throughout my presentation. And ultimately, due to this significant heterogeneity that we see in ASD, targeted individualized approaches may be the way forward in clinical management. And then ultimately, from the basic science perspective, to understand human development, because the characteristic features in autism, that is cognition, speech, and behavior, are those features that make us most human and human as a species. And I think the understanding of this condition really will provide significant insight into certainly the genes and proteins that are involved in these unique traits. So I'm a PhD-trained scientist, and this is how I like to view things. You'll see this Venn diagram kind of approach come up in all of, in many of my slides. As many of you know, autism is a heterogeneous spectrum disorder involving impairments in three domains of function. And I presented these as bubbles with a gradient of intensity of the color attached to them. Of course, the three impairments are social communication deficits, restrictive repetitive behaviors, and language deficits. And if one has certain scores on different tests that are administered for testing for ASD, you can be grouped into these different subcategories: Asperger's syndrome, autistic disorder, childhood disintegrative disorder, or PDD-NOS. And, of course, as of this year, the DSM-5 groups these under ASDs. But what's important, and this will come up in many of the data that I show when we look at families, is that when you look at even identical twins that have the same genome, you can have quite a wide range of the clinical presentation of ASD. And often there will be individuals who are subclinical, so-called broader autism phenotype, overlapping attributes that may be lesser in phenotypic manifestation that may exhibit features that are seen in other neuropsychiatric conditions, etc. So I think one has to really think about this when you're thinking about how the samples are ascertained. Most of the data I'll talk about are from research cohorts that we've been studying for 10 to 15 years that were collected using ADIR and ADOS gold standard type criteria. And I'll talk a little bit at the end of my presentation of how we moved out into primary diagnoses by physicians and caregivers and looking at the difference of the genes that may be involved. So also, there's many coexisting mental and health conditions. This is data from a recent study that came out of the province. I live in Ontario, which is the largest province in Canada. So in 14% of cases, we see attention deficit, sleep disorders in roughly 15%, learning disability, 22%, depression, 28%, anxiety, 45%. And then in what I just group as health conditions, digestive system disorders in 47%. And then what was grouped in this report, brain and spinal conditions, in particular epilepsy, in upwards of 50% of cases. So I think if you look in the literature, depending on what's being tested for, you'll see different associations. But things like intellectual disability, epilepsy come up pretty much across the board in all studies. And I think this is really relevant. The issue of how samples are ascertained with respect to these research studies is critical. And one of the take-home messages I'd like you to take from this presentation is that, in fact, I think we're looking at really the bullseye from that Venn diagram in my last slide when we're teasing out which genes are involved. And when we start to ascertain other cohorts and other types of studies, we may see other subsets of genes or allelic variants that may be contributing. So this is another Venn diagram showing really in a rough way what we know about the genetics involved in ASD, the so-called genetic architecture. And this is consistent data if we were to take, say, 100 or so consecutive diagnoses from we've done this actually from Newfoundland, a province on the east coast of Canada, and run a very detailed clinical assessment, run clinical microarrays, done karyotyping, and now done exome sequencing. And these are roughly the statistics we see. So then roughly 10% of cases, we would see a so-called ASD-related syndrome, Fragile X syndrome, which, of course, is studied extensively here, tuberous sclerosis, PKU, Rett, Timothy, Pataki-Lubsky. And in total, there's 108 different categorized syndromes that have an ASD or an ASD-like clinical presentation. So it is, in a way, a medical genetic condition, at least in some cases. Rare chromosomal abnormalities in roughly 5% of studies, again, depending on how these cases are ascertained, including 15q11.1 to q11.3, et cetera. And more recently, using microarrays, rare copy number variants, or CNVs, roughly in an additional 5% of cases, in particular chromosome 16, p11.2, deletions and duplications of 7q11.23 and others, and I'll come back to this a little bit later. And then more recently, rare, highly penetrant genes, mutations typically found at the sequence level, although some of these are also detected by the rare CNV approaches, including neurexins, the synaptic scaffolding, shank genes, etc. So in total, I think we can usually see maybe 15 to 20% of a genetic explanation for a naive clinical cohort that would be tested in these different ways. So, of course, there are the twin studies that indicate heritability estimates may be ranging in 50 to 90%, depending on the study. So there may be lots of other genes that are still yet to be identified, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. In total, efforts of the Autism Genome Project, which we belong to, and I'll present some of this data, we've cataloged now 124 ASD risk genes, whereby there seems to be good evidence that these genes are, in fact, bona fide autism susceptibility loci, and another 55 loci, so the specific gene may not yet be known because it could be a genomic-type disorder, that have been identified now. And we use this as a list to compare a lot of the genomic scan data we generate to compare if particular variants identified are associated more often than not or enriched in case versus control type or family studies. So this type of list is really important to have these genomic features we can test against. And interestingly, every single one of these genes or loci is also implicated in intellectual disability. Okay, but not every intellectual disability gene has yet been linked to autism. Okay, so keep that in the back of your mind. This is data from, we have a new study that's unpublished from the Autism Genome Project, where we've now genotyped an additional 2,100 or so trio families This is an international study, a Canadian contribution, a lot coming from the United States here. And we're just kind of finishing up the analysis. And in these 2,000 or so families, we were able to detect 89 different individuals that have what are considered to be a pathogenic chromosome CNV that is attributed to cause the autism in this individual. So these are in the highly penetrant loci that I mentioned on the last slide. So if you use a million feature microarray, I'll talk about in a moment, you'll see at the minimum probably 4% or so. Other studies have shown maybe 7% of pathogenetic variants that could be identified. So this is a highly significant finding in rich compared to match controls. And I won't go through all of these, but you'll see lots of different syndromes, these chromosome CNV deletions, et cetera, that are shown here, and then some larger chromosome abnormalities. Now, that's not to say that this type of technology doesn't detect more of these. These are the ones that we have really, really strong confidence. These changes are the ones that are causative in these individuals. So the technology to study the genome, the genetic yield of finding these variants has increased as we can look at a higher resolution along the chromosomes, of course. And at least in our hospital, karyotyping using cytogenetics to outline the morphology of the 46 chromosomes is still actually the primary test that's used in clinical genetics, at least in Canada. I think it's probably the same in the United States and many places anyways. This is being supplanted by microarrays. In 2007, the first million feature arrays were introduced. And now in our research lab, we typically run 2.5 million feature arrays for most experiments. And the introduction of clinical microarrays occurred when the price came in the range of karyotyping, so roughly $300 or $400 per test. So now, as I'll talk about later, we're running thousands of clinical microarrays in our hospital diagnostic laboratory. So in Canada, DNA diagnostics is done in the hospitals. And now more recently, of course, we can sequence the gene encoding regions of the genome or exome, the protein coding regions, or the entire genome at differing prices. It costs us roughly $1,000 to do an exome sequence, which is about 1.6% of the genome, and roughly $2,500 to do a whole genome sequence. So I would argue that these technologies, of course, are higher resolution because of the increased coverage. We'll move into the clinical realm as they start to approach the price range of the microarrays, and of course with quality and yield of data. Well, what I wanted to point out, and I don't have a lot of time to talk about this, this is what the basic research side of my laboratory does a lot of, is genome annotation. Even if you have a whole genome sequence, for the aficionados, I'm talking 40 to 50x coverage across the entire genome, and you use the tools that are available now, and compared to the gold standard human genome sequence, which is actually Craig Venter's genome sequence, which was the first identified individual sequence using Sanger technologies, long read, and compare the annotation from Complete Genomics, which we do a lot of whole genome sequencing with, they have the best annotation. There's still lots of variants missed, okay? So we're really good at detecting single nucleotide variants, but when it comes to finding these insertion deletion variants and CNVs, we're missing roughly 50% of them. So this is just a plot showing 79 genomes from actually parents of autism, of ASD kids, and comparing that to the size distribution recovered compared to the Venter genome annotation. So it's just a point to say, you know, even though we're generating a whole genome sequence, it doesn't mean we have all the variants yet to do the association testing, but that will come with time. So this is, I think, probably one of the most interesting findings that hasn't got a lot of attention in the literature. Many of you are aware, of course, of the many studies that have done CNV screens of different cohorts, like the Simons collection and the AGP collection and AGRE, et cetera, and others. And then, of course, there was exome sequencing. There were four major papers published last year that in total sequenced roughly 600 trio families, and then what I've done is added here another 100 unpublished samples from our unpublished data. And the take-home message here is if you compare the top 10 loci that come out of the CNV screens And I'll hone on this a little bit later, so don't ruin your eyes looking for the list. But and then the top 10 shown on the right from the exome studies, they're essentially mutually exclusive. Okay, I've actually kind of fixed the data. It doesn't really matter in the list. There's only four genes that come out in two or more unrelated cases when you do the exome sequencing looking for what are called predicted loss of function damaging mutations. And I'll define that a little bit later. So this was really compelling to me. That tells you a few things. One is that there's lots of genes out there. We don't have a lot of data yet, at least from the exome, that validates that these mutations are indeed bona fide autism, identifying autism risk genes. And also, perhaps there's different mechanisms contributing to the impact at the expression level or the genomic level, leading to the pathogenicity. So there's been a large-scale project now called the Autism Sequencing Consortium that we're part of that will sequence roughly 10,000 families over the next 5 years using primarily exome-based trio approaches, although our group is doing whole genome sequencing. My understanding is most of that is funded now. We're funded to do about 2,000 families, and I'll talk about some of that preliminary data. So because of these caveats I showed in the last few slides, our approach to doing high-resolution genome analysis is still use a multiple technology approach. So every sample I'm going to talk about has been run on high-resolution microarrays, and we actually run a minimum of 2 microarrays per DNA sample because they give you a different yield depending on the coverage and distribution of the probes on that microarray. And we started out doing exome sequencing. We're still doing that because we have a big funded project to complete 8,000 samples, families actually, over the next few years. But we're transitioning into whole genome sequencing because the increased yield, and I'll show you this data a little bit later. Ultimately, we combine all of that genetic variation data that's captured and then do association studies in the manner that I talked about by comparing to these gene lists, et cetera. Okay, so let's move on to the copy number variation ASD, section 2 of my presentation. So these are the top 6 highly penetrant risk genes, or CNV loci, that are identified now from most of the population studies that have been conducted. Actually, what I did on that previous slide is I combined the Autism Genome Project data and the Simons data because they were run on the same microarray, the Illumina 1 million feature array. Both high-quality studies, did a lot of validation, good data, and it was easy to combine them because they were run on the same technology. And from that, I picked the top 6 loci that come out. And these are now all loci that are signed out in most clinical genetics laboratories that if you have a damaging mutation, in particular a deletion or a loss of function event, it will be signed out as being the etiologic variant in autism. So I'm going to talk about the 4 that are highlighted in red. So in chromosome 16, P101.2, deletions and duplications, you see the deletion more often than not in autism and the duplication more often than not in schizophrenia, although you can see the inverse. In our Canadian cohort, we see this in about 0.8% of new ASD diagnoses. And then there's Norexin 1. And then there's deletions of the PATCH-D1 DDX53 locus. I'll come back to this a little bit later. And more recently, the reciprocal region, so the region that's deleted in about 90% of cases of individuals that have Williams-Buren syndrome. In autism, we see the reciprocal duplication event. And in fact, we first described this back in 2006, I think, in a case, and now it's been replicated in many different cohort studies. And the synaptic scaffolding, SHANK1 to SHANK2, SHANK3 genes. Now, what's really interesting, I think many of you know this, but I certainly think this is one of the stories that needs to be followed, is that none of these loci is exclusive only to ASD. We see them coming up in the schizophrenia, bipolar, ADHD, intellectual disability studies. I'll talk about SHANK1 and social anxiety. So it doesn't appear that any of these loci, perhaps the PATCH-D1, DDX53, are specific to ASD. So they tend to provide risk, depending on deletion duplication at different levels, towards a neuropsychiatric outcome. And there have been some functional studies performed. We did some work with Gooder and Rappold's group in Germany to model some of the mutations in the SHANK2 locus by, in this case, overexpressing point mutations in an autosomal dominant negative manner to show that synaptic spine volume is reduced in this ASD mutation. And, of course, other studies in Rett's and Fragile X and others have shown related mutations lead to differences in the spine volumes that presumably are the underlying contributor to the phenotype. I just showed this as one example, but this is, of course, one of the areas that needs a lot more development because we can readily identify these candidate risk mutations, but then we need to actually often do functional experiments to confirm that indeed they are contributing. So this is the general model that I'd like you to think about when I present some of this genome-wide data we talk about here. I've labeled this primarily as CNV events, but it could be any damaging mutation we're talking about. And on the x-axis is really the site in the genome, so the gene or the locus that's involved. And then on the y-axis is the susceptibility to ASD. And then in the general population, there's a given risk. So the ASD threshold, males are closer to this threshold for perhaps reasons unknown, maybe evolutionary reasons, genetic reasons, behavioral reasons. Females are lower. And then the idea is that if there's a specific genetic event in certain genes, it may push you across this ASD threshold. So these are the loci that I'm referring to, at least a subset of them, that are so-called highly penetrant mutations that, in fact, in autosomal loci, typically it doesn't matter if you're male or female. If you have this damaging mutation, it will push you across this ASD threshold. So it poses a hypothesis that if you look at these highly penetrant mutations, you would come closer to a 1-to-1 ratio in male to female versus the 4-to-1 that's typically seen in the population. And I'll also show you in a moment, our data is starting to show that trend, although the numbers are still a little bit low. So these are the chromosome 16 changes, et cetera, I talked about. And then there's other events that we see more often enriched in cases versus controls, but we do see them in controls in some cases. But so these seem to be more risk factors, and it may be, in fact, that gender plays a role in their expression, or it may be that other mutations need to be involved, or it could be environmental contributions that give that kind of final push across this gray threshold that's shown here. And then there's other variants that appear at more of an equal frequency in cases and controls. It may be a relatively small enrichment in cases over controls. And these are less penetrant. They typically present in variable expressive kind of presentation in families where, in some cases, carriers have the phenotype. In other cases, they don't. And then there's the vast majority of the rest of the genome, where it doesn't matter if your copy number variable, you might have some other disorder, but it has no relation to ASD. So as I pointed out, and then I'll talk about the X chromosome, of course, if the gene is on the X chromosome, females can be protected because they have two copies. Okay, so just to come back to what I was mentioning earlier, really plays into the ascertainment of how the samples are collected, the study design, et cetera. We see, again, in every single case where we're looking at an ASD locus, an intellectual disability locus has been found as an ASD locus. In some cases, some of these loci are identified in ASD cohorts or ASD-related cohorts, and then in other cases found in different disorders. So we've started to look at, in these larger cohorts, where we have gender information, of course, and where we have high-resolution data, and we have parents, we started to look now to see if this issue of the highly penetrant mutations starting to approach an equal 1-to-1 ratio male to female. And the key in doing this type of study is you have to have relative confidence in calling a pathogenic CNV, a highly penetrant CNV is, based on that population genetics data I showed on the last slide. So the take-home message from this slide is, although, again, the numbers are small, when we look at the latest data we have from these 2,100 families, when we can identify the so-called highly penetrant CNVs, we're coming into the 2-to-1 male-to-female ratio, whereas in the cohort, we're at 6-to-1 male-to-female. So this is kind of interesting. It supports our hypothesis. As we get more and more data, we see this starting to level out. I'll show you some results a little bit later why it will never be one-to-one, because there are some autosomal loci that only express in an autism phenotype in males. Okay, so we think that it will keep getting closer, but probably never equilibrate. Another interesting finding, I don't have the slide here, but in the Simons study published by Saunders et al., they looked at the de novo SNV rates in the cases that had de novo presumed penetrant CNVs, and the SNV rate, albeit again a very small sample size, is much less reduced, suggesting that in fact that CNV is the event that is pushing that individual across the ASD threshold. So I'm not going to talk a lot about the details of how we do these experiments, but in this case, we've looked at 72 unique regions impacted by de novo CNVs that are deletion events impacting those gene lists I talked about earlier. And then we can use different types of programs. This is using a network analysis, an algorithm called NetBag, that groups genes based on their functional pathways into these types of clusters and groups them into their gene ontology groupings. So we can see that more often in cases over controls, we'll see genes involved in synaptic signaling, chromatin remodeling and transcription shown in blue, the MAPK and other signaling pathways grouped together in these presumed pathogenic events in these individuals that have been studied. So if you can just keep that in your mind, I'm going to come back to this in one of my slides in the last part of my talk. This is the latest data. This is the tightest cluster with the most nodes in it that you'll see. There's been other studies published, and we've integrated the data. Typically, these are the pathways that come up in a significant association-type test. Now, I'm going to go through I think three for sure, maybe four specific loci to show you some of the features that we're observing. This is the SHANK1 locus on chromosome 19, I think it is. So an autosome. From that CNV study, we detected initially in a Canadian family a deletion. This is the gene shown here, the 5' end. Each line is an exon. A deletion that encompassed part of SHANK1 and also this other gene that's nearby here. So we got kind of excited by that because there had been, of course, evidence in SHANK2 and SHANK3 implicating these genes in ASD, and this is the third, or actually the first member of that family. So we quickly contacted our collaborators, and Thomas Bergeron's group in France had another deletion, a de novo deletion, in actually a Swedish case that also impacted the 3' end of SHANK1 and the gene on the other side. So the common region of overlap here is the SHANK1 gene itself. Did lots of sequencing, found some other putative mutations, now have some functional data to validate these. But ultimately, you know, because there's only these two rare cases, we had to have lots of controls and do some functional experiments to test to see if we thought these were in fact pathogenic events. And the power in moving this forward was to actually look at the family, the Canadian family that we first made the observation in. So as you'll see as I build out this family, in many cases we have access to detailed family information, phenotype information, or we have the ability to go back and collect more when we need to. So this was the index case, the male shown in the black box who is ASD. And the mother was a carrier, so she passed this deletion to her son. And the astute geneticists in the crowd will see as we build out this pedigree that only the male carriers express ASD. Peter Zatmari, who some of you know, a psychiatrist who actually collected this cohort, studied all members of the family quite extensively, in particular the females, to see if there was any clue of ASD or social anxiety. After a long time, he came to the conclusion that, in fact, no. And since then, we've identified additional mutations in this gene. In every case, it's a male. But this was the family. It was quite interesting. The grandfather in the stipled box, he was still alive, actually, at the time we were making these initial observations. And his DNA was in the laboratory from the initial collection in the study. And we interviewed the mother of the index case, and she described it, the dad. And we could predict, of course, that he would be the deletion carrier. He was a truck driver, went on long trips, for a long time, would come back and not interact at all with the family, go and work on his stamp collection. And the family never understood why. And sure enough, that he probably was, he was on the spectrum and he carried this deletion. He passed away kind of just after we published this work. But then we could predict, of course, any of the male carriers would be on the spectrum who we could study. Now, what was also interesting, of course, we looked in controls. We've never seen this deletion in controls. So why some individuals are more severe on the spectrum and others are not, we don't see this at all in controls. So we think this is a highly penetrant mutation, but we can't really predict the severity based at least on the data we have at the present time. For the molecular biologists in the crowd, we did this experiment. We initially found the CNV using microarray screening at relatively the same time we were doing exome and whole genome sequencing. I targeted this family because we were testing technologies, and just by coincidence, we picked the right one. But we did exome sequencing and found what would be considered to be a so-called pathogenic mutation, a stop mutation on chromosome 5 in the protocat here in HGA11 gene, which is actually one of these risk genes that comes out from whole genome association studies of common genetic variants. And interesting, again, this is on a different chromosome, chromosome 5. It co-segregates with the phenotype. So had we only, so we've sequenced lots of other patients. We've never seen this come up in our microarray or exome data. So we think it's just randomly associated. But had we only had the exome data, we probably would have made the false association. In fact, that was the pathogenic variant. And the probability of this happening, by random chance is actually 1 in 262,000. So depending on how you look at it, we got lucky or we got unlucky. But the point is that you need to have as much information to make the proper call. So this is the second example. So this is the top third, the third locus that comes out. We see this in roughly deletions in this locus in roughly 0.6% now of our males in our Canadian cohort. I'll walk you through this. So these are the kind of maps that I look at all day, and a lot of clinical geneticists are starting to look at. This is your chromosome. This is the length of the chromosome here shown in, I think these are probably 10 kilobase segments or so. This is the PATCHD1 protein coding gene, so there's three exons here. We had done a study, it was eventually published in 2008, where we found a deletion in one family that knocked out part of the PATCHD1 gene, and that's shown here, and this was an ASD family. And then in our genome-wide scan that was published by the AGP in Nature in 2010, the algorithms were designed to look for only protein coding CNVs, genes affected by CNVs, not non-coding RNAs or non-genic regions. So in fact, when we looked for other things, we found that there was this cluster of CNV deletions that skipped upstream, some cases up to 600 or 700 kilobases away from the protein coding gene, and we found these in males. And they were always, at least initially, inherited from the mom. And then when they were identified in some other cohorts, including ADHD, intellectual disability, when we went back and looked at the male, at the kids, they actually also were on the autism spectrum. So these deletions are also knocking out this non-coding RNA. It's not conserved at the sequence level, but it's conserved at the structural level, and the exon intron structure between human and mouse. And we think that, in fact, this is actually a second locus. And I won't show you the data today, although we've now generated induced pluripotent stem cell lines on a few of these deletion carriers and the PATCHD1. And while we initially thought that the non-coding RNA may be involved in regulating the protein coding PATCHD1 gene, it turns out not to be the case. We think that, in fact, it's involved in a way that the Fragile X gene may work in regulating lots of other genes in the genome. This is very preliminary data, but it may just be a coincidence that these two are sitting side by side. From the genetic testing perspective, this is a highly penetrant marker. There's lots of females walking around who have these deletions. In fact, I got an email this morning from a clinical lab that just found one of these in a prenatal test where there was a structural abnormality detected by ultrasound. And in every case where this chromosome is passed on to a male, as I said earlier, they will have most likely ASD. So we've also done sequencing and find mutations in the protein coding gene. Now, In some cases, we've also got exome or whole genome sequence data, and we can find additional mutations in some other ASD risk genes. And just summarized in this slide here, a very rudimentary genotype-phenotype correlation that if you have a mutation in the PATCHD1 protein gene on the right-hand side, you have intellectual disability or kind of higher functioning autism. On the left-hand side, you have Asperger's broader autism phenotype. The right side is intellectual disability. Left side, Asperger's, BAP, higher functioning autism. And then in some cases, we've now found mutations in other genes in the genome. We have a more severe phenotype. So the second hit seems to push them a little bit more in the severe autism direction. This is based on about 20 different mutations, so the sample size is still quite small. But now that clinical microarrays, so at the time we published this, did not cover this upstream region of the genome because they typically target gene-rich regions, we didn't have a lot of that data from clinical labs, but now it does cover this interval, and we're getting lots of these cases coming through now. This is the third example where we identified rare deletions at the GEFRIN1 locus on chromosome 14q21.3. And just to cut a long story short, these were originally found in our ASD cohort, but subsequently found in the literature in epilepsy and schizophrenia. Some of these were rare inherited events, and some were de novo events. When we went back and looked at the carriers who had the inherited deletions, they, in fact, were also had clinical presentation, in particular ASD. The interesting thing here is that the common region of overlap is in these exons shown here, and these encode what's called the G domain of this protein here. And subsequently, we've done lots of sequencing now, and wherever we find what we think is a pathogenic mutation, it's in fact in the same G domain of this protein. And in retrospect, this actually wasn't too surprising because a lot is known about this protein. It's a key scaffolding molecule at inhibitory synapses. And the G domain is involved in kind of this formation of lattice structures. They're kind of schematically shown here. So it's been known actually in clinical genetic setting that recessive mutations in GPHN cause Stiff-Mann syndrome. From genome-wide screens, we see heterozygous deletions in schizophrenia and neuroligin 2, which is one of the binding partners. Neuroligin 4 come up in autism, and the ARHGF9 in epilepsy and intellectual disability. GABA receptors that are also interacting here in epilepsy and autism. And I'll come back to this at the end of my talk. There's this beautiful study that has shown that, in fact, cellular stress induced by seizures actually can affect the messenger RNA encoded by this gene. So this could be an environmental contributor that's detected, in this case, at the genetic level. And if you group these protein products into a functional network, you can actually predict perhaps which other genes we may find mutations in later downstream. So this is a so-called functional network developed based on human protein interaction data from model organisms in yellow, and information from pathway databases in blue. And in this boxes are the genes that have already been identified to be involved in these different neurodevelopmental conditions. You have ASD, intellectual disability, schizophrenia, epilepsy genes all in the same network, and you could predict probably that you'll find mutations in one of these conditions or something related once we look deep enough in other cohorts. Okay, so I think it just poses a few questions. Why do we see mutations in the same network in so many different clinical presentations? Of course, one explanation could be that these clinical presentations are, in fact, a disease continuum, and we've kind of artificially grouped them. And perhaps one could argue that maybe we should use the genetics to help redefine, at least in these individual cases, what the phenotype should be categorized as. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the whole genome sequencing part of my presentation. I'm not going to talk a lot about our exome data. I mentioned the 100 cases we added to these other published studies. We're finding interesting things, but, you know, we really had this problem at... The yield wasn't as great as we had hoped. So why were we considering transition to whole genome sequencing? As mentioned earlier, there's estimated to be over 100 risk genes involved in autism. So if you wanted to try to actually model multigenic contributions, again, you have to have the best technology to capture all of the variants possible. We know that CNV studies and exome studies yield different genes and loci, as I talked about. Of the 119 ASD risk genes I mentioned we used in our comparisons, 11 of those genes actually, or 9% of the known ASD genes, have at least one exon that are not captured by the target arrays you use to pull down the exon sequences for the actual sequencing itself, including things like SHANK2 and SCN2A. So if it's not there to sequence, you're not going to find a mutation. And in roughly 5% of our Canadian cohort, there's mutations that have been detected, or presumed mutations in the introns, in intergenic regions. I talked about PATCH-D1. There's a well-characterized region in the intron of Norexin-1 that is pathogenic. It's been shown in family studies now. And non-coding RNAs, the PATCH-D1 antisense, et cetera. And of course, there's the issue of 25% of families on the spectrum. I didn't talk about the exome studies that have been published. I'd only looked at de novo mutations. So one has to also look at rare inherited mutations. And then many of the ASD risk genes are on the X chromosome. And of course, there's this 4-to-1 male-to-female gender bias, suggesting also the X chromosome needs to be studied. And again, most of the exome studies don't give you sufficient coverage to deal with this 50% reduction when you're looking at males versus females. So we've been able to resolve that using the whole genome sequencing approach. I won't go into too many details. The other obvious thing that came out when we did the whole genome sequence comparison to the equivalent samples that were also tested using exome approaches, and again, for the aficionados, we use the Agilent SureSelect, the best technologies, the exact same Illumina HiSeq, and ultimately you get much better, much tighter coverage, as shown on the right-hand side, across the exomes when you're doing whole genome sequencing versus introducing this capture step. You're much better at capturing mutations at the intron and exon splice junctions, and because of the uniform coverage, we just get better representation of mutations. It's pretty simple. So we did this pilot study with Autism Speaks to see, you know, if the time was right to think about starting to transition from whole genome from exome to whole genome sequencing, really with the hope that whole genome sequencing might replace the microarray and the exome all in one single experiment. So this was a multi-million dollar experiment, and we just found out actually this morning the paper was accepted, so we're pretty excited by this. So we took 33 families from the TASC collection. This is targeted to be it's called the Autism Simplex collection, but as you'll see, there's lots of cases in here that have siblings that are on the spectrum. These are in the AGRE repository. These are all diagnosed by Peters, Maria, McMaster, ADIR, ADOS, blood-derived genomic DNA, so we didn't have problems with cell line-induced artifacts. Extensive family clinical data. We had one control that we included for QC and tracking, and we tried to represent the 4-to-1, typical 4-to-1 male-to-female ratio. These were all samples that had been run on at least 2 million feature microarrays, and these were so-called CNV negative. Okay, so we wanted to try to enrich for non-CNV mutations in at least starting our pilot experiment. The sequencing was done at the Beijing Genomics Institute, roughly 36x coverage, covering 99.8% of the euchromatic genome. And the concordance between the SNVs and the SNPs on the microarrays was very high. This is kind of a good experiment when you get in the 99.1% to 99% range, so that was great. The validation rate, we validated everything I've talked about, was over 90%. The CNV and indel calling was less than 20%. I say that's on a good day. That's our best data. So it comes back to the slide I showed earlier. That's, even though we have the sequences, it's still hard to call these because the algorithms haven't been developed yet, but that will come with time. But we don't yet have that variation data, so anything I talk about here we think is going to get better when we can call more of these variants. I won't go into a lot of detail here, but we get lots of genetic variants. We talked about this a lot today with people I was meeting with. But I think the most interesting feature was we found 1.3 exonic de novo, what we call damaging mutations per ASD individual, using whole genome sequencing, and this compares to the 0.77 to 1.19, depending on the study, from those four exome papers I talked about earlier. And this is largely, you know, as far as we can tell, a result of just getting better coverage across the exon that I showed in the previous slide. It doesn't have anything to do with the ascertainment, as far as we can tell, based on the male, female, the age, or anything like this. It's really just a technical issue. And I'm going to go through this relatively quickly, although we talked quite a bit about this with the clinical people today. This is how we kind of determine how we would call what would be a clinically relevant or damaging mutation. So we started with the 32 trios. We did the SNV and indel calling. We looked initially for de novo variants, shown on the left-hand side. We did a curated annotation. So there are standard kind of algorithms one uses and tools, a program called GATK. Ryan, my postdoc, went through and actually hand-annotated all this, and as I'll show you later, we would pull out some mutations that were filtered out. We looked at inherited and X-linked variants. Again, the quality of the sequence and the coverage gave us the ability to do this, and also autosomal inherited variants. And then we defined rare deleterious variants as loss-of-function, nonsense, splice site, frameshift predicted damaging missense mutations. This is kind of the standard that's developed from exome sequencing experiments. Then we perform extensive medical annotation by comparing to databases, animal model databases, OMIM, these Canada gene lists I talked about, and then wherever possible, we did family segregation analysis and genotype-phenotype correlation. Every variant has been validated using Sanger sequencing, and then a team of clinical geneticists, genetic counselors, the genome scientists, the referring physician, and then some other experts, dysmorphologists and others have been called in to look at the mutation data that was accumulated. So to come back to the technology, this is a very busy slide, but I think it's quite relevant. We found the higher de novo mutation rate that I talked about earlier. Whole genome sequencing captures 2.7% more annotated exons with coverage, or 5x coverage for variant calling, than the exome sequencing. The coverage difference was even more prominent on the X chromosome and at the gene splice site, so that gave us more of the variants. So 6 out of 56 of the so-called damaging mutations identified would not have been captured by exome sequencing in this that I'll talk about. The manual annotation I talked about going into the X chromosome de novo variants that would have been filtered out led to another 5.3% yield. And then 11 of the 119 genes would have had one exon or more missed by the exome capture. That's what we estimate here. So then, as I mentioned earlier, we haven't called all the indels and CNVs because we just don't have the tools to do that in a robust manner yet. So the yield will just get better over time. The exciting thing is we found in about half of the families, in 16 out of 32, deleterious genetic variants that may have implications for clinical management and genetic counseling. So this moves us from the 12 to 19% realm. If you look at the exome studies published that include microarray and exome sequencing, including our own data, up into the 50% range. This has to be replicated. It's very exciting, but this is our first, you know, this is our first kick at the can. We found de novo mutations in 6 out of 32 or 19%. Using the exact same criteria that were performed in the exome papers, and X-linked or autosomal inherited alterations in 31% of the ASD probands. So I'm going to pick, I think I have four families that I'm going to take you through here, but I could tell equal stories actually for all, for the 16 where we found what we think are clinically relevant variants. This is a summary of the genes associated with ASD. There are the known genes, where mutations have been already described in autism or intellectual disability. The candidate genes, where there may be other supporting evidence in a case in the literature or from the exome studies. Or novel genes based on overlap with the human OMIM genes. And then also mouse phenotype database, which we actually use quite extensively in this comparison. It was in a productive way. So mutations of interest were found in 16 families in which 5 carried more than one presumed loss of function alteration, deleterious mutations in 10 known ASD genes in 10 families, 8 candidate ASD genes in 7 families, and 4 novel genes were found in 4 families. And then highlighted in asterisk are the genes with de novo mutations in the proband. And as I said, we're just starting now to look at the non-coding, intergenic, and other variants, so the yield will get higher. So here are the 4 examples I wanted to highlight because I thought some of these genes might be interested to some of you in the audience here. In the first case, we identified a de novo nonsense mutation in the autosomal Caprin1 gene. Caprin1 is a gene is similar to FMR1 gene, which causes Fragile X syndrome, of course. And the gene product directly interacts with the FMR1 protein. So in this case, the age of diagnosis was 7 years old. There's also OCD. fetal distress, bowel, breathing problems. And this de novo mutation was identified, which we've now found in two unrelated cases mutations in the same gene in another study where we've gone and done sequencing. So we think that this result, had we had it earlier, may have informed on family risk in this family. The gene discovery would have potentially led to earlier identification. And regarding stratification in clinical trials, for example, this family might be identified for glutamate signaling molecules in these type of clinical trials. And the second example is a little bit more complex. We identified missense mutations in the X-link AFF2 or the FMR2 gene, and also an autosomal potassium channel gene, KCNQ2. So what you can see here is the three-generation family. So as I mentioned, AFF2 is also known as FMR2. And in this case, it's inherited from mom. And then the KCN gene is coming from dad, who's actually Asperger's syndrome. And as you can see, the female sister is a carrier of both of these mutations. We've gone back and looked, and she has perhaps subclinical features. But the interesting point, of course, is that she's fully loaded. So when she has her kids, she needs to be monitored quite closely. We think that perhaps the KCNQ2 gene is explaining the benign neonatal epilepsy that are seen both in the index case carrier and the father here. And the FF2 is contributing perhaps to the autism phenotype. But again, this is a complex case where we see inherited variants coming from both sides of the parental lineage. And at least in these cases, we go back three generations and track where the mutations are coming from. In the third example, we found loss of function mutations in the vasoactive inhibitor or VIP gene. And this was an interesting case because this mutation has been mimicked in mouse models and it's been implicated in circadian rhythmicity, and the mouse knockout have social cognitive deficits. When we found this in the index case, of course, we check in the rest of the family. So the sequencing was done in the two parents and then the index case. And we found the equivalent mutation in the male sibling, who at the time of collection was too young to actually be tested. But this was several years ago. And went back and talked to Peter, and sure enough, this boy has subclinical autism. When he called him back in, actually had a full diagnosis. So we think this is probably arising due to gonadal mosaicism in probably the father in this case. And so this might have been an interesting example where the detection of the mutation may have informed on the clinical risk in the second-born child. And apparently there's antagonist drugs for VIP that are used in cancers that might be considered as a treatment in this family. But again, just identifying that having the pathway involved can inform on the drug treatment possibilities. And then the last example I'll show you is really kind of a neat case where we detected a deletion in the SCN2A gene. This is a sodium channel gene that's coming out in quite a few epilepsy and autism studies now. And in this case, we found, as I'll show you in a moment, a deletion of one single exon. And we found two affected female carriers had a parent de novo deletion in exon 18, which causes a frame shift of the rest of the protein. And again, the question is, was this germline mosaic? It turns out that when we look closely at the whole genome sequence, the dad seems to also carry the same mutation. But we could never validate it using Sanger sequencing or quantitative PCR or anything. And more recently, we've done some other experiments, and we think we can show now that there's been an insertional transposition of that segment of DNA in a different chromosome. And these two female SIBs are carrying now the essentially unbalanced derivatives of that event. So having the sequence actually probably has helped us resolve the complexity of the underlying genotype here. And I'd like to show this example, A, because SCN2A was one of those lists that are not totally covered by the exome capture approach. And irrespective, it's almost impossible to call deletions of single exons using exome data. It's just very hard technically to do this. In this case, the breakpoints are actually in the intron, flanked by repetitive sequences. So we wouldn't have found them by microarrays because it's too small. We wouldn't have found them by exome sequencing. It was really the whole genome sequencing that allowed us to find this small exonic deletion. Okay, so then just some wrap-up comments. I actually don't remember how many slides I have here, so let's see how it goes. I wanted to point out that, at our hospital, we've really moved towards genome-wide studies, which has generated a lot of unbiased data that we can use in these kind of clinical comparisons. And this is a slide depicting the increase in use of DNA, RNA, clinical microarrays, exome sequencing over the last couple of years. In particular, I'll show you examples of how we're now exploiting the existence of the clinical microarray data to support and drive our research studies. And I think the same will happen as we start to do exon sequencing or whole genome sequencing in the clinic. There's this issue of neuropsychiatric phenotypes associated with CNVs. In clinical genetic setting now, these loci are being signed out both in prenatal and postnatal assessments. And if you look at even the most characterized loci on chromosome 22q, 15q, 1q21, you have this spectrum of phenotypic outcomes at the same locus affected. Of course, there could be other genetic contributors involved, but I think this issue of penetrance and variable expressivity of the phenotype of defined mutations is something that we need to study a lot more of. I'm not sure how far we're going to get on this, but I think there will be some progress as we get more higher resolution sequence data, et cetera. We actually turned this to an advantage to increase sample sizes and to get at this issue of perhaps there is this continuum of phenotypes across neuropsychiatric, neurodevelopmental disorders. And our group and others have taken the same approach. We ran the same microarrays I talked about for our autism study on ADHD cohorts and autism cohorts, and then compare the data. And in this study of ADHD, I won't go through all the details here, but we identified the astatactin 2 gene as our number one hit from the ADHD study, and this, in fact, was also validated, of course, in our autism cohort to significance, genome-wide significance. And ASTN2 was interesting because for two reasons. One, from the functional perspective, but also embedded in the intron is the TRIM32 gene. It's a much smaller gene in the intron. ASTN2 encodes the astatactin 2 gene, which is a neuronal cell adhesion protein. It's part of a gene family. There's AST1 and ASTN2. And I'll tell you, we have not found as many mutations in AST1. We have found a few de novo mutations, but the story seems to be with respect to autism in ASTN2. And there's, of course, been lots of mouse studies implicating this in neuronal migration. And also TRIM32 is an interesting gene in that it's involved in the fate of neuronal stem cell lineages. So in that initial study, if you look at the families that we identified de novo or rare inherited mutations, they either had ADHD or autism, but autism was the consistent phenotype that came out. And there was a hint in the data that, in fact, it may be influenced by the gender of the carrier of the mutation. So from these early observations, we figured we want to take this out across a larger cohort. So that left us, to take the kind of traditional approach and go and sequence hundreds of cases and controls, or to go back and exploit these clinical databases that are now running these clinical microarrays. So I mentioned at our hospital, we're running about 1,000 or so ASD cases per year and something like 6,000 general neurodevelopmental disorders. And we could, within a week, go across all these laboratories around the world and collect something like 90,000 cases, of which 63,000 have a neurodevelopmental disorder. And we have population controls, I mentioned here, 40,000. We have something like 80,000 controls now. And then look to see how these AST1 and AST2 loci are affected in these clinical cohorts just by email, essentially, comparing databases. And to cut a long story short, we collected lots of deletions. These are all the deletions shown in red. The ASTN2, the major isoform, the so-called long isoform, is shown on the top. It spans a very large segment of DNA, roughly a million base pairs or so. ASTN2 has multiple isoforms. I'll come back to this a little bit later. So the extent of the deletion along the chromosome is shown in red. In the top panel is the male carriers, and the bottom panel is female carriers, male controls, female controls, and then controls of unknown gender. The take-home message from the study is we saw significant enrichment of ASTN2 exonic deletions in male NDD patients versus female patients, and this is significantly associated. And also versus the male controls for deletions in the same region. And we also found that this critical region comes out near the 3' end of the gene shown here. This is the so-called smallest region of overlap. And there's a significant enrichment of deletions affecting multiple ASTN isoforms. So this is one of the common themes I kind of alluded to earlier. When we're seeing highly penetrant mutations, they tend to affect the common regions where more of the gene isoforms are expressed. Okay, and in this case, it seems to have an impact in the male gender. And so we're really excited by this finding because now, in the past, when we were doing these types of studies, we didn't look specifically at gender, in particular at the autosomal loci, because we didn't have the gender data from a lot of the controls we used. And we've spent a lot of time now to develop that resource so we can do these type of correlation studies. And, of course, we've gone back now and looked at the relative expression levels of the different isoforms of ASTN2 and can indeed show that the region that's most usually affected in males in autism or NDD is indeed at the left-hand side of this slide, which is shown in this this transcript quantitation assay here. And I mentioned earlier the GEFRIN1 story, and I'll just come back to this. I think there's lots of questions. So if indeed we've identified genetic variants that may help to explain the underlying factors in perhaps 50% of the cases, let's see if we can replicate that using the whole genome sequencing. These are good targets to start to do functional tests. And I had mentioned that this kind of neat study was published in Brain showing irregular RNA splicing in patients that have this type of epilepsy shown here. And in fact, when you go back and look at this paper, they could show that cell line-based studies, when you induce stress via temperature, hypoxia, alkalosis of the brain, which mimics what can happen in the seizure phenotype, you see the same G-domain of the GEFRIN gene actually spliced out of the messenger RNA. So, in fact, you might imagine that where we're only seeing a very small proportion of deletions at the genetic level, there could be other environmental insults, perhaps the epilepsy, in these individuals that actually affect the mRNA. So you'll never detect, actually, mutations when you go and look at the DNA. You need to also look at the RNA for functional effects. So I think this was kind of a neat way to think about the environment, and I would say in this case the environment is a small e as opposed to what I like to think of as a capital E when we think of environmental toxins, for example. And then just a few more slides here. From this new data, I talked about the 2,100 or so CNV families that we'll be publishing on soon. We wanted to come back and look at this issue of the CNV locus overlap with the loss-of-function mutation data coming from the exome projects. And shown in this Venn diagram are the different groups of data. So the CNV data shown in red and the SNV data from the exome study shown in blue. The ASD mutation data shown in the ASD gene list we're typically using, and then some other studies from intellectual disability. And the take-home message here is there's not a lot of overlap of these genes, as I showed earlier in that table, that come out when you do this comparison. But if you start to group these proteins based on their protein-protein interaction pathways, in this case using a program called DAPL that allows you to test for this, you see a significant enrichment, actually, in protein-protein interactions of 1.5-fold increase in this case over what would be expected. And this is kind of a fancy slide that's similar to the one I showed you earlier, the networks, and it essentially shows that these genes that were previously not overlapping are being pulled into the same network. And we can test this in different ways using different programs. And ultimately, it's pulling lots of these mutations and different genes into the same general network. Now, what's important to point out is this still would only account for about 10% of the cohort if you were to use the same sequencing and CNVs in the same study. So we think that as you get more and more mutation data and you can build more robust networks, you'll see a much, say, more expansive bubble come out of this. But the more and more data we generate, we see more tight cohesion in these type of nodes and networks that we're developing. And then the other point, of course, is how you translate this information, particularly the CNV data now, and then I guess coming is the exon or whole genome sequencing data, in the clinical realm. And I just wanted to show this one slide. We were developing our grant for whole genome sequencing and genome for the Genome Canada grant that was just funded. And I asked our clinical genetics group to come up with a management protocol, clinical management protocol, based on finding mutations in well-established CNV loci or ASD-associated syndromes, including Fragile X, Rett's, et cetera, shown on the top here. And it was interesting. Depending on who you ask, you get different recommendations. And it took me 2 weeks to put this slide together and to get the clinical geneticists and the developmental pediatricians to come to a consensus of what they would recommend if you find this particular CNV or this type of mutation in the gene. And in all these cases, they've been studied for probably well over a half dozen years or so. So when we think about the clinical recommendations coming around some of the new mutations and new CNVs that are just being identified to date, I think we've been trying to advocate that as you publish your genetic data, you should also have a section in your papers that recommend what you should follow up on with the families. Is it relevant for genetic counseling? Is it relevant for particular medicines? Is it relevant for follow-up assessments, clinical visits, that type of thing? But this was just one exercise we went through, and I think this is certainly going to be one of the challenges going forward, is how to use the data. And this, just finally, I just wanted to kind of tell you other things we're working on. We have a grant that will fund us to do assessment of high-resolution CNVs and exomes, although I'm going to try to push the government to move us into whole genome now based on this new paper, where we'll be testing primary ASD referral clinics, so 15,000 cases over the next, it's a five-year grant, we're 2 years in now. And then also we're testing CNVs and related neurodevelopmental disorders. We've started to generate IPS lines, I mentioned for PATCH-D1, but for known mutations to study mechanisms. Evdokia Anaganastu, who many of you know in Toronto, has a clinical trial network she's developing, and we'll be doing all the genotyping prospectively, hopefully, and also, of course, retrospectively for the patients going into her clinical trials. And spend a lot of time integrating our data into clinical management policy planning, including trying to convince the government that they should pay for this type of testing. So it worked for clinical microarrays, and we'll see if we can get it to work for exon and whole genome sequencing. And ultimately, as I mentioned, our group is funded to do roughly 2,000 whole genome sequences in families over the next couple of years, so there's going to be a lot more data coming. And with that, I'll close and just acknowledge many of our team on the right-hand side. We meet with our group. We invite all of the genetic the families that are enrolled in our genetic studies once a year to a family day where we share our information with them and try to involve them in the decision-making process of how they want to get the data back. And also, in many cases, when the timing is right, we talk about how we want to actually present the data in our papers and how to publish it, in particular because there's always a lot of media associated with these papers, and we want them to get the data before they read about it in the newspapers. And with that, I'll close and be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Once you know the genes and those pedigrees, does it help you get, understand the specific phenotypes in those families? For instance, like the VIP where you had a circadian rhythm gene, do they have more sleep abnormalities or any other examples like
that? So that was a good example where, Ryan, the postdoc, did this one and looked at the mouse phenotype, and I don't remember the specific clue that came out of that paper, but he went back and looked in the mutation carrier, and it was exactly the same. It was the circadian rhythm phenotype. I didn't talk about, in a lot of cases, we had the CHD7 came up, charge syndrome mutation. It was a parental carrier, came from the dad, went back and checked, and in fact, he had charge syndrome. He also had Asperger's, it was undiagnosed. And the boy who was the index case went through clinical genetics and had a diagnosis of a charge. So it was after mutation was found. The Kallmann syndrome was an interesting case where there's not really anything in the literature, at least that I could find, linking Kallmann's to autism. But at the time, that child had an autism diagnosis, but lots of other challenges. He went through eight different clinics And the week we found the mutation, he got actually a Kalman diagnosis the same week. So had we had that in advance, we would have saved that stress. So there's lots of these examples. In many cases, we've identified carriers and gone back and found that, in fact, they're subclinical or they were never assessed and they're actually on the spectrum. We talk all about this in the paper. I know we had talked about this earlier, and also a few of you. I would say I don't have the quantitative data for this, but in almost every single case when we identify one of these rare mutations and we look in the family and we identify who's the carrier and go back and look, they would fit some type of a diagnosis.
Yeah. Do they ever help inform treatment for this?
Oh, yeah. So for the Kalman syndrome, actually, it actually helped focus the steroid treatment. For the ASD, I think for the seizures that we're seeing, I'm starting to inform on the treatment, mainly from the genetic counseling perspective right now.
So from the whole genome sequencing, so 50% of them had what you describe as pathogenic mutations. Does that mean that we're getting to the limit of genetic contributions to the etiology of autism, and that by implication that the other 50% is going to be more environmentally induced?
Right. So this, we're really conservative when we look at this data. We very carefully worded in the paper better than I probably did in this presentation. So the 50% yield can be attributed to some of the clinical presentation in that patient. In almost every case, other than the Kalmans, it links back to the ASD. The Kalmans itself may be linking to ASD. We don't know yet. So it could be a syndromic form. But if you look at the mouse data, some of the mutations may be contributing to social anxiety, for example. And there could be other mutations there. But at least in these 50%, we would use the standard clinical reporting criteria that something would have reported back to the families. But I don't think in every case this is the cause of autism in that individual. So that's yet to be seen. But are we approaching the yield? If you look at the missing variants still, that's why I showed you that slide, 50% of the intermediate-sized indel CNVs are still not annotated. So there's going to be a lot more there that are detected as we have the ability to find them. Will it account for 100% in our cohort? No. How far it will go, we don't know yet.
Since you find that women are carrying these mutations, but then it passes through to the male son, is it also passing through to the female children, and therefore we will see a continuation of the mutation passing through the generations?
Yeah, certainly for the X-linked loci, that's true. And for a few of these autosomal loci I talked about, like the astrotactin 2, yes. It's interesting now, I've been talking to a few of the clinical people. What's happening probably more often than people know is prenatal clinical microarray screening is really becoming quite popular. In particular, in advanced maternal age and in to accompany ultrasound where there's some type of a structural defect presumed to be identified, and they run clinical microarrays. And often they're finding these ASD loci come up, and it's really causing a real ethical dilemma of what to do with this. And until recently, if you don't have the gender information, you don't even have that to rely on in these papers. So that was one of the reasons that we've been quite excited by at least the astrotactin 2 data and the Schenck 1, where we can actually add some more information to inform on the decisions. But, there's probably more coming. Yes?
Yes. In the example, there was a family with two mutations. Well, one mutation and a copy number variant. How do you analyze the function of this, the variance and the mutation, and how can we determine what is the weight or the additive effects of these two hits?
So we used that algorithm I talked about, to compare the to the known genes and to the extent of the mutation, that type of thing. Everything we're using right now is population genetics approach or the family-based segregation analysis. So we're not doing any functional, mutation by mutation functional analysis. It's just, for us, we can't do it. So that kind of thing, we wouldn't sign out on, you know, we were talking about this afternoon, we wouldn't sign out on that additional mutation. We would include it in the report, typically as a variant of unknown significance that needs to be monitored and followed. But we wouldn't sign out that second mutation as a pathogenic event. It's very tricky. And of course, the real challenge is as the literature develops, you need to be able to go back and iteratively assess what's in the literature and then reinterpret the data and get it back to the families. And that's going to be the real challenge in, you know, genomic medicine.
I don't know if that's the family that Ray was talking about, but you had one with a 64 KB deletion and addition mutation.
That's the SHANK1. I think he was talking about the PATCH1.
Oh, the PATCH1.
I think.
But the one with 64 also has an additional mutation that was segregating along the family, and everybody had it. But the females didn't show the phenotype, but the males did.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. So then how can we say these two probably contribute to the phenotype if we don't see it in the female?
No, it's the second one I argued that it does not contribute to the phenotype. So, and that's just, again, based on lots of sequencing and cases. And we've never seen a mutation in that gene in anything else we've studied. So.
Yeah. So also, if I may, I have another question. So you show the different technology right now, you know, CNV, exome sequencing, and whole genome sequencing, but it seems that there are limitations, obviously, for the single approach. So what is the strategy then when you start? You know, you mentioned that in your new study you are proposing to do CNV and exome sequencing, but then you might miss something. But then at the same time, and if you do also with a whole genome sequencing, you mean something, so if you look at the expression, for example, the gene. Yeah. So either way, there is something that we're going to miss anyway, right?
It depends how much money you have.
Right? Yeah. So that's why. So if you had to go, what is the best strategy to go for?
Well, I showed you in that slide, in integrated, run the microarrays and do whole genome. But that's two and a half times more expensive doing an exome. I think that we were talking about this afternoon too. The original exome papers that came out last year, they were really rushed, and when you go back and look at that data, they're finding a higher mutation rate than they originally reported. But it's still not approaching what we're getting for the whole genome sequence data. So it's an issue of, you know, it's a cost benefit. And we need to do that type of analysis. So I think we're doing this on a research basis now where we have a grant to pay for it. We had already budgeted it out. I would argue that if you can only run one technology, I would say you should run the clinical microarray. It's more, you get a better yield than this, at least in our hands, an exome. If you had to do two and you had $2,000, you do CNV and, you know, microarray and exome. The nice thing of the whole genome, if you get up to 40 or 50x coverage, it's static data, and as the tools get better, you will be able to mine out the vast majority of variants. So, and you only have to do it once. So that's kind of been our rationale. We were criticized heavily by the grant review committee that, you know, you should just do exome and increase your sample size. So we had to do a lot of this kind of comparisons. And again, when you have the whole genome data, eventually you'll find these variants. It's the same as the old days in microarrays. We didn't have the tools to find them, but that will come.
We are finding mutations, and I have a patient with a patch 1 mutation and some others. So it's, we are finding, I think our diagnosis rate, it's about 30 to 40% when we use, you know, our own algorithm. So I think it's very important for the clinicians to come up with a list, because the laboratories will really pay attention to those genes and do fill the gaps and extend the depth.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, there's diagnostic labs here in the States and other places that are now testing for ASD risk genes, and you know, some of the genes on their list, I look at, and I spend my career developing these lists. I don't know where they came up with some of these things. So maybe they know something we don't know, but it's a real challenge in the field. Right now, to do the genome comparisons, you really have to have these lists, as you said. And people use OMIM and other kind of categories. So I think the it's very early days, and you know, there's a lot of press around the American College of Medical Genetics list for incidental findings that came out a few months ago or last month. And interestingly, we at our hospital developed our own incidentalome list that in part overlaps with that, but in part doesn't. We have some of our own genes that we have had to deal with. So it really depends on the site and what type of disorders you're studying and what the family, you know, if it's a pediatric or adult setting, that kind of thing. You know, so there's no simple answer. And as we talked about this afternoon, you know, the numbers are really becoming an issue. So the amount of time that is spent on a typical clinical microarray report, at least in our institution, is about 2 hours, actually. I think that's too long. You probably do it an hour. But for the exome data, they're spending, you know, 4 or 5 hours, I've heard. I don't know what they're going to do with the whole genome data. You know, that's the way it's going.
I was just wondering if you were doing any whole genome sequencing on childhood schizophrenics.
We're not. Ann Bassett, who's in Toronto, has some families she's doing whole genome on. But I don't remember if they're pediatric cases or not.
And the other question I had, it just as an example, in the like the 22q11 deletion where you have the phenotypic differences, any sense on why one is autistic, another one is psychotic? Do they have other CNVs associated with them that might explain the phenotypic differences?
Well, that's a good question. We published a paper with, actually, Ann, a few years back where we asked that question. We took the 22q deletion syndrome, and in particular those that had schizophrenia, and we tested using higher resolution microarrays to see if there was any other loci that could explain the more complex phenotype, for example. And we did not find any significance. And then there was a paper in Nature Genetics by Evan Eichler's group that looked at other loci. They found the same thing when they looked at 22q, that there was no second hit association. But in other loci, like the 16p and that, in fact, you saw a more severe phenotype when you had an excess burden of CNVs elsewhere in the genome, which makes sense. You know, it's just more genes affected. So the 22q is a tough one. It's been studied for a long time. And, you know, we see duplications in 22q more often in autism than deletions. I think that's something. But it's very strict genotype-phenotype correlations in these genomic disorders, I think, is going to be pretty tough.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.